Thanks, Brother Michael, and my dearly loved brethren and sisters in our Lord Jesus Christ. Well, on our last class, we met young Joseph as the only godly follower of the promises at the age of 17, the record tells us in chapter 37, living in an extremely difficult family environment, and yet we find that he's so responsive to his father. And the overtones here in the type are quite amazing, are they not? He's so responsive to his father's will that despite his own misgivings about going to seek his brethren's welfare, he goes. He goes after his brethren to seek their welfare on behalf of his father. He goes out of the Vale of Hebron where the patriarchs had finally settled themselves. He goes out of there over to Shechem to find them, which place in itself we will return to a little later as well, not tonight, but in a later study, because it is a highly significant place in Joseph's life. But just to pass across that quickly, you'll remember that Shechem in the lives of the patriarchs was a place where decisions were made. It was an important place where Abraham made decisions, where Jacob made decisions. But more than that, it symbolises throughout the scriptures sincerity and truth, those two qualities that God was seeking above all. And here Joseph goes out to find his brethren at that place and finds neither sincerity and truth in any of them, and finds them not even there, and finds them out on the caravan routes at Dothan, a place that means two pits, and there he discovers them. They see him long before he gets there. And one of those pits without any water in was to be a place that they eventually threw him. So here we've got the father's representative as the good shepherd seeking the welfare of those who are lost. And what an amazing place the whole record of Joseph starts there, with this young godly son of Jacob seeking, because it's the interests of his father, seeking the well-being and welfare of his brothers. And he eventually finds them, as we know. I'd like you to come to chapter 37, verse 18. Because we're going to spend a little bit of time at the end of chapter 37 tonight. And there in verse 18, he's saying, when they saw him afar off, that's his brothers, even before he came near unto them, they conspired against him to slay him. And they said one to another, behold, this dreamer, or this master of dreams, as the margin says, comes. Come now, therefore, and let us slay him and cast him into some pit, and we will say, some evil beast hath devoured him, and we shall see what will become of his dreams. Before he ever came near. And isn't that so reminiscent of our Lord's own experience, who the authorities of his day, the scribes and Pharisees and the Sadducees, they never actually got close enough to Jesus. But when they saw him come near and threatened his position, their position, should I say, they had already closeted together and were already scheming about how to remove him. You know, it's interesting that in the record we're told that Pilate even worked out that it was for envy that he was finally delivered. And that's exactly what the record here tells us. In fact, we have two scriptures that tell us it was envy that was the real cause for deliverance of Joseph into the hands of his brethren. In fact, it says after the second set of dreams, you'll notice in verse, if I can find it here, verse 11, and his brethren envied him. Now, previously that had said they'd hated him, and they still did. They still hated him. But it had turned into envy now. There was something here that they saw in this man that they envied. And Stephen, in Acts 7, picks it up and actually says that that's what they did. For envy, they delivered him. Well, this master of dreams, as they called him, was coming. They, of course, used that term cynically. They were sarcastically threw this term back in his face. The master of dreams comes. Ha, ha, ha. Listen to all these wonderful things that he says he's gotten from God. But in fact, he was the master of dreams in more ways than one. Not only had God revealed things to him and not to them, for which cause they envied him, but he knew what those dreams were about. He was in touch with what God was thinking. And there, as the master of dreams, so they called him, comes along, in their hearts is murder and lies and deceiving. They've already schemed a whole thing to cover up all of their evil intent. They've already woven this web of deceit in their minds. And we'll see what will come of his dreams. We'll see, all right. They saw in time, as time unraveled, what became of his dreams. And they didn't for one moment imagine that anything like was going to happen. Verse 23 tells us, and when he finally came to them, came to pass when Joseph was come unto his brethren. So all the time he's coming across the landscape and they can see that it's him. They're scheming and working out what they're going to do, and finally he comes. And the first thing they do is take off his coat, as we looked at last time, his coat of many colours that was on him. And they took him and cast him into the pit. And the pit was empty and there wasn't any water in there. How symbolic is that? And they sat down to eat. You know, they're off in Dothan, supposedly feeding their flocks. You know, there's perpetual water in Shechem. You never, ever run out of water in Shechem. And here they are over in Dothan, and there's no water in the pits. Why are they at Dothan? Because they're getting away from the truth. They're out there because there's bright lights. They're out there because there's excitement, and they're after things that were not godly. They're moving away and further away from the truth. And here's this young boy, seeks them, even out there, and finds them. And when he gets there, he's thrown into a pit. Cast, the word says in verse 24, cast into the pit. These were not gentle men. These were cruel, ruthless men, like Levi and Simeon, who'd caused Jacob's name to stink in the land previously, when they'd tricked the descendants of the region of Hamor and had killed all those men after they'd been circumcised there in a deceitful scheme. Well, this is the same men. And here they flung him into this pit, verse 25, and they sat down to eat bread. They ripped off that coat that was a symbol of his father's love upon him. It became a symbol of the truth that he possessed. It became a symbol of his godly spirit. And they hated it. In fact, they envied it. And they ripped it from him and cast him into a pit. Well, just imagine that scene. Can you think Joseph wouldn't be crying out? He's there to see about their welfare. He knew some of the schemes and things they'd been up to in the past. He'd talked to his father about it at length. And now he's down in this pit, probably bruised and hurting, and crying out to his brothers. And they're just having a wonderful time at the top, having a feast, sitting down and eating, taking absolutely no notice of his cries. Just turn the page, a couple of pages, chapter 42, verse 21. Chapter 42, verse 21. And this is what the brothers said later when they came up to Egypt when Joseph is there. Years later, 20 years later, they said one to another, verse 21, "We are verily guilty concerning our brother in that we saw the anguish of his soul when he besought us and we would not hear. Therefore has this distress come upon us." The one thing that stuck in their mind is him crying out in that pit. You can imagine what that was like. It was, they called it, 20 years later, they called this the distress, the anguish of his soul. And it still burned into their brains, though they were so heartless at the time. And it goes on. Reuben says to them, "Spake not I unto you, saying, do not sin against the child, and ye would not hear?" They just sat there, letting him cry in that pit, call out to them, "Please, please listen to me. I've only come to see, to bring a message from Father." They totally ignored him and went on doing whatever they wanted to do. They're callous and hardened men, pitiless men, with not an ounce of emotion or empathy in their beings. And there's not a single thing that this boy had ever done wrong to any of those brothers. Not a single thing. And now he's down in the pit at their mercy. Verse 25 goes on. "And they lift up their eyes and looked, and behold, a company of Ishmaelites came from Gilead with their camels bearing spicery and balm and myrrh going down to Egypt. And it was Judah that stands out now. And Judah said unto his brethren, what profit is it that we slay if we slay our brother and conceal his blood? There's no benefit in murder. Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother after all in our flesh. And his brethren were content. And then there passed by Midianite merchantmen, and they drew and lifted up Joseph out of the pit and sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver. And they brought Joseph into Egypt. Merciless and mercenary Judah. Now here Judah emerges. We've already heard about Reuben in the record here, but here Judah emerges, and we never leave Judah to the end of the story. It's very interesting to see the first record of Judah. Because this whole story really hinges around two people, Joseph and Judah. And Judah becomes a representative of his brethren. He becomes a spokesman. He's unquestionably a natural leader. Because he just makes a suggestion, oh, and they're all content. Even his older brothers, because he was fourth in the line. And Reuben doesn't seem to have too much influence because of his own actions. In fact, the first three boys in the family had disgraced themselves. And now the fourth, Judah, takes the lead here and says, well, after all, he's our brother. And, we don't make anything out of him just by killing him, putting him in a pit. Surely we can at least make a bit out of him and get the blame off our hands at the same time. Well, they decide that they're going to sell him for silver. 20 pieces of silver, it tells us in verse 28. 20 pieces of silver. Silver here in his thinking is more important, more valuable. Silver was more valuable in his mind than his brother. And Judah's going to go down a path. God's going to take him all the way just to understand how valuable his brother really was. And silver was not going to feature after a while. In fact, silver dogs the steps of these brothers from here on. Silver turns up time and time again in the record until they hated the stuff. God led them down a path until they despised the stuff. They didn't want it anymore. And at the same time, there was a growing love, a growing respect, a growing desire to consider their brethren. To start with each other, and later, even Joseph himself. Which is a remarkable thing in its own right. And you know, brothers and sisters, let's not pass too quickly over some of these things. Because sometimes silver gets in the way of our interactions too with our brethren. Sometimes silver is more important to us than our brethren. And we've got to be honest when we're looking at this record. You know, we can see all kinds of lessons and stories and just pass on and move on in our life and not ever let any of it penetrate. But there's a lesson here that's going to be reinforced over and over again, that our brethren are far more important than silver. It doesn't matter what we think, brethren and sisters, of money and possessions and stuff. The most important thing we have is the fellowship of each other. And it ought to be our prime concern and our prime care. And if money is taking us away and silver is becoming too preoccupying, we'll be taken down the same path as Judah and his brethren and have to learn the hard way what God thinks of all of that. Well, they sold him for 20 pieces of silver. And we might have thought, oh, would it be nice if they'd sold him for 30, since he's a type of Christ. But remember this, that they got 20. We don't know what the Ishmaelites got for him or sold him for when they got to Egypt. Because they were obviously going to make a cut on top of that. And do you think they were content to just make another piece of silver? Or were they going to at least make 50% on top of that, which would have brought it up to 30 pieces of silver? How significant is that in terms of the overall time? But just imagine, brothers and sisters, whether that was the case or not. He was sold here and sold again when he got to Egypt. Just imagine Joseph's feelings through all this. Joseph's protestations. He's drawn up out of that well, and possibly with the expectation that his brothers finally are listening to him. We don't know how far away they were from that well, but we may assume that if he's down in a deep well, he's not going to hear a great deal about what's going on. He could hear voices, but if you put yourself down a narrow channel, you can't actually hear much sound. Sound's got to bounce all the way down. It doesn't get down there very easily, so he probably didn't hear a great deal. So now his brothers finally come and they lift him out. I need to find there's a great company all around, and he may have hoped that they had rethought and that they were just punishing him. And he knew they hated him. But to his horror, he finds they're bargaining in front of him, bargaining to sell him to these Ishmaelite merchantmen. You know, brothers and sisters, Joseph saw who was doing all the talking. He must have tried to protest, but dare not, because he would have had his mouth clamped shut or beaten across the back. But he saw who was doing all the talking. Who do you think was doing all the talking? Well, the record tells us whose idea this was. The record tells us that everybody in that party was content with Judah's suggestion. Judah is evidently in control here. He's going to do the bargaining. And one day, he was unwittingly later going to come face to face in a very difficult situation with this same man that he'd bargained to sell as a slave into Egypt. But remember that Joseph is standing there. Imagine what that's doing to that poor lad as he sees his own brothers, for whose welfare he has come. He's only there for no other reason that his father was concerned, and he said that he would go and bring his father word again. And now it looks as though he's never going to bring his father word again at all, because his brothers, well, they've turned against him and now are going to sell him into slavery. He didn't know what on earth that meant. And flashing across his mind must have been a million things that he could hardly have made any sense of. And this is a sensitive, godly young man that's being treated like this. What would have been in his heart? Terror, probably. Confusion. Was he going to turn on them and abuse them and fight them? What hope would he possibly have had? And was that the spirit of this man? Well, we read of none of that. We read of nothing that he said. The record is totally silent, because as a sheep is dumb before a shearer, so was he here in prefiguring the spirit of the great Messiah who was yet to come. But you know, we do have a divine viewpoint on this. Just turn a few pages over to chapter 49. Now we know that chapter 49 is Jacob's outline of the details of his sons, the blessings on his sons. And in verse 22 of Genesis 49, we read the blessing on Joseph, and it goes like this: Joseph is a fruitful bough, even a fruitful bough by a well, whose branches run over the wall. It sounds all wonderfully positive. That Joseph was growing up like a fruitful plant, producing the fruits of the Spirit in his life, basically. There's a brief overview of the young early life of Joseph, and in fact it was a characteristic of all his life, and these tendrils ran across the walls all over. Verse 23 says, "The archers have sorely grieved him and shot at him and hated him." Oh, who are these? You know what the RSV says? It says this: "The archers fiercely attacked him, shot at him, harassed him sorely." Who are these archers? Who are these archers that did that? There's no one else in the story but his brothers. They're the archers. And what's even more fascinating, brothers and sisters, and this is the only time the word, the Hebrew, or the English word archers is translated by a Hebrew phrase. In every other place, it's just archers, just a Hebrew word for archers. But in this place only, in the Old Testament, it's not just the normal word, Hebrew word for archers. If you have a look at the Hebrew, it's the masters of arrows. So these men were the masters of arrows. It's a very similar phrase to the master of dreams. So they're calling him the master of dreams. And now Jacob, under inspiration, later calls them the masters of arrows that have fiercely attacked him and shot at him and harassed him sorely. Just hold your hand there in Genesis 49 for a minute. Come over to Psalm 64. We'll be back in Genesis 49 in a second. But in Psalm 64, there's some very interesting words that you could almost think were written about Joseph. But it's a psalm of David, so his experience was very similar. Hear my voice, verse 1, O God, in my prayer, preserve me, my life from fear of the enemy. Hide me from the secret counsel of the wicked, from the insurrection of the workers of iniquity, who whet their tongues like a sword and bend their bows to shoot their arrows, even bitter words. Now these men took more than bitter words as arrows. They actually took to physical violence as well. Read on, that they may shoot in secret at the perfect. Aha, that's one thing they hated about him. He was just so good. He was always doing what his father wanted and they couldn't stand it. It's exactly the reason that the archers later shot at the Son of God. Suddenly, verse 4 goes on to say, do they shoot at him and fear not? They have no fear or compunction. They encourage themselves in an evil matter. They commune of laying snares privately. They say, who shall see him anyway? They search out iniquities. They accomplish a diligent search, both the inward thought of every one of them and the heart is deep. What an amazing thing. Because here we've got his brothers called the masters of arrows. And David was going through the same experience with those around him. And so possibly, brethren and sisters, at times in our lives, we might even experience that to a lesser extent. Harsh words or whatever that might come our way. But what was Joseph's response to all that? Well, what was David's? Look at verse 7. But God shall shoot at them with an arrow. Suddenly shall they be wounded. So they shall make their own tongue to fall upon themselves. All that see them shall flee away. And all the men shall fear and shall declare the work of God. For they shall wisely consider of his doing. And the righteous shall be glad in Yahweh. And shall trust in him, and all the upright in heart shall glory. That was exactly Joseph's spirit. He wasn't going into battle with them on his own terms. He wasn't going to fight with bow and arrow, with all their arrows that were coming. He wasn't going to fight on the same ground and send all the same missiles back. Which is often, brethren and sisters, is our response, is it not, at times? But his confidence was going to be in God. He was going to wait until God would vindicate him. And then all men would fear. And the outcome in the end would be that all would come to see the true principles that God had laid down. But you come back to Genesis 49, verse 24. Let's keep reading. We just read about these masters of arrows surely shooting at him. But, verse 24 says, his bow, that is Joseph's bow, abode in strength. And the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. Now, the next little bit, really, in fact, in most translations, is not in parenthesis. And it hasn't got the words, from thence is the shepherd. But it reads like this in most translations. Now, his hands were made strong by the mighty God of Jacob, by the shepherd, the stone of Israel, even by the ale of thy father who shall help thee, and by the Almighty who shall bless thee with the blessings from heaven above, blessings of the deep that lieth under, and blessings of the breast and of the womb. You see, brothers and sisters, the picture there we're given of Joseph is that while the archers were going to shoot at him, and he was going to experience great difficulties at the hands of his brethren who would shoot out their tongues and their fists at him, his bow would be made strong by God. And the picture here is of God putting his arms out, the mighty God of Jacob, putting his arms around. And when Joseph himself had no strength and not even able to pull a bow or not even able to do anything, the mighty God of Jacob was coming around with that bow. And he was going to make that bow mighty strong in the end. He was not only the mighty God of Jacob, he was the shepherd, the stone of Israel, and the El Shaddai, who had brought all sorts of blessings into the family of the patriarchs. And that God was going to strengthen Joseph in this. You know, when we think about those titles that are used here, the God of Jacob, the shepherd of Israel, the rock of Israel, and El Shaddai, the nourisher and care, all of them are about a father guiding, caring, nurturing, directing. It's not the mighty warrior. God here is a mighty warrior. It's just going to smash the enemy to pieces. It's a wonderful God who is so concerned as a shepherd, as the leader of Jacob, as El Shaddai, the great nourisher, that he was going to come around Joseph and make him strong. You know, that's exactly the story of Joseph's life, because that's precisely what the mighty God of Jacob did in Jacob's life. They shot sore at him and did all kinds of things, and he never ever retaliated with all their arrows. But the mighty God of Jacob came behind him and made him strong, strong enough to turn them around and save them in the end as the great shepherd of Israel. So God was going to work through this man. So it wasn't as if the strengthening of his hand was to shoot them down in flames, but in the end, to help them see their great need of God himself. Now, there's a tremendous contrast here, isn't there, between Joseph and his brethren. Upright and truthful is Joseph, but deceitful and lying is the way they're portrayed in the record here. One loved the word of God and the visions, and the other hated them. Joseph's there abiding in Hebron and is only set out seeking them. But they're going. They're on their way out to Dothan, to the world. One is, in truth, the master of dreams, the other the master of arrows. One seeking his brethren, the other conspiring to slay. You couldn't get a more dramatic contrast than that. And they're shooting at the very one who's out there to save them, who's after their welfare, and who in the end God strengthens to turn around and save them. It's just an amazing story, isn't it? The whole outworking of this, the life of Joseph, is just one amazing story. Now, if we come back to chapter 37 for a moment, we find that in the end of that chapter, we find the grief of their father in verse 32. They sent the coat of colours that they'd and brought it to their father and said, "We've found this, know now whether it be thy son's coat or not." And he knew it, and he said in verse 33, "It is my son's coat. An evil beast hath devoured him, and Joseph is without doubt rent in pieces." You know, Jacob was half right, half wrong. An evil beast had devoured him. That was true. But rent in pieces? No. That evil beast was the collective brothers. And though they'd ripped his coat off, they hadn't destroyed him. Because there was something more to this man. You know, we've got shocking deceit and hypocrisy here. As Jacob goes into grief and mourning many days, and verse 35, "And all his sons and his daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted." They rose up to comfort him, knowing that they had the very means to remove his anguish by telling him what the truth was. And yet, brothers and sisters, that terrible picture that we see there at the end of chapter 37, before we point the finger, just remember that Joseph is a type of Christ and we are his brethren. And we are described in our native form without the influence of God in our lives. When we go astray, we're described as an evil beast. And Jacob now goes into a terrible time of mourning and depression, from which he really didn't recover for some years, because this was such a terrible blow. The son of his right hand that he just loved so much, because here was the godly spirit that was the spirit of the fathers, that now he's gone. But what about Joseph, verse 36? The Midianites sold him into Egypt under Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh's and captain of the guard. He was manhandled by them and beaten, humiliated. They didn't treat slaves too well in those days. And taken off into a strange land, he had no idea where he was going, what would become of him. He had no idea why it was all happening. And what must have been going through his mind is, but why is this all happening? Why did they do this? All he'd done is come to seek the welfare of his brethren. There's no justice here, brethren and sisters. You know, and in this sort of day and age that we tend to become accustomed to thinking that we all have all sorts of rights. We can stand up for them. We can do all kinds of things. And no one can push us around. Well, what about Joseph? What rights did he have? And God's taking him through this. And it was all because he loved the word of God. It wasn't anything to do with things he'd done himself. It was because of his love for the scriptures. It was the love of the visions that he'd had. And he just wanted to share them with his brothers. He wanted to influence them in godly ways. And now look where he is. And what would become of his father? Would he ever see him again? What about his younger brother? He was deeply concerned about him, no doubt. And now at night he's shackled as they moved through to Egypt. No coat. Frightened, no doubt, crying to God. Why? Now that's the burning question of the story of Joseph. Why? Why is Joseph going through all this? Why didn't God take the brothers into captivity? Why didn't he lock them up with the Midianites and drag them off into Egypt? Why? Why this man? He'd done nothing wrong. Well, we know it was going to be the forerunner of a great type in the parable. And that the only sinless man was going to go through the same experience. And remember this, that Joseph didn't know the end of the story like we did. He had no idea what he was doing or where he's going. You know, many of the messianic psalms, Psalm 22, for example, Psalm 69, you know, they're very worthwhile to sit down when you've got a moment of meditation. Just pick up Psalm 22, Psalm 69 and others and just read them with Joseph in mind. It's just staggering to see how well they fit Joseph. And he preceded David, who wrote them. Well, I'd like you to look at just one. That's Psalm 77. I'm not going to spend a lot of time here. But Psalm 77 is one such that's just a magnificent illustration of what's going on in the mind of this young 17 or 18-year-old boy at this particular stage of his life, as he's trying to come to grips with these set of circumstances that have been brought upon him. In verse 1, I cried unto God with my voice, even unto God with my voice, and he gave ear unto me. In the day of my trouble I sought Yahweh. My sore ran in the night and ceased not. My soul refused to be comforted. I remembered God and was troubled. I complained and my spirit was overwhelmed. He couldn't sleep. He couldn't get settled. And he cries to God. Verse 4, thou holdest mine eyes awaking. I am so troubled that I cannot speak. Not only couldn't he sleep, brethren, he couldn't even speak. That's how troubled he was at this time. I have considered the days of old. the years of ancient times. I call to remembrance my song in the night. I commune with mine own heart and my spirit made diligent search. And now finally his mind is starting in the night as he's awake all night. He's starting to think of all these things that he knew from before. Verse 7, will Yahweh cast off forever? Will he be favourable no more? Is his mercy clean gone forever? Doth his promise fail forever more? Hath God forgotten to be gracious? Hath he in anger shut up his tender mercies? And I said, this is my infirmity. As he began to stop and think in the early hours of the morning, out in the desert somewhere as he was going down into Egypt, and to remember and to consider. Verse 10, I'll remember the years of the right hand of the Most High. I'll remember the works of Yahweh. Surely I'll remember thy wonders of old. I'll meditate also in thy work and talk of thy doings. Thy way, O God, is in the sanctuary. Who is so great an isle as our God? Thou art the isle that doest wonders. Thou hast declared thy strength among the people. Thou hast with thine arm redeemed thy people, the sons of Jacob and Joseph. His mind roved over the, with an amazing spirit, over the visions that he'd had, over the promises that he'd heard from his father. You know, brethren and sisters, a tremendous lesson in that, because there are times that hit us. We run into a brick wall, or circumstances come upon us, even perhaps slowly, and get worse and worse in our lives from time to time as God takes us down the path of trial and difficulty and tribulation, a path that he'll take us all down at times. And what is our response? Oh yes, we might wonder, we might question all kinds of things. We might say, has God forgotten to be gracious? But in the end, we've got to come back and consider and remember. And remember the foundations, the works of Yahweh from of old. And think about his way and his wonders and his wonderful purpose and his redeeming hand. And it put Joseph back on the track again. Brother Roberts had this to say in Ways of Providence. He said, follow Joseph in his journey from one dreadful experience he has plunged into another and far worse. The father's favourite, accustomed to the ways of love and the surroundings of comfort, he finds himself in the hands of unfeeling and mercenary strangers who regard him as a chattel and think only of how much he will fetch when they arrive in Egypt, exhausted with grief, broken down, unable to cry anymore. It is not possible for human situation to be more agonising or human prospects to be darker. I think nothing we ever experience, brethren and sisters, probably takes us quite to the edge that this young lad had gone. And yet, God is with him and directing his way and fitting him for exaltation and for untold usefulness in the execution of the divine purpose. It's that big picture, and Joseph is beginning, obviously, as he's going to Egypt, is obviously trying to put that all together. He can't make sense of it all. But his mind was following the path that David's did and Messiah's did later. And he thought about all that God had done. Brother Roberts continues, the kingdom of God lies ahead, and Paul has told us that through much tribulation we must enter therein. How much and of what sort we require, God knows, and not we ourselves. Therefore, let us humble ourselves under the mighty hand of God, and he will exalt us in due time. Joseph's agonizing journey to Egypt was a journey to exaltation, though he didn't really appreciate that or think that it was at the time. And so is ours, if we, like Joseph, fear God and do his commandments and commit our way to him. But exaltation comes not at once. There were dark and dreary years before Joseph. Let us not therefore be impatient. But at this very point, as we enter the depths of his suffering and sorrow and anguish of soul, chapter 38 breaks. Now, we're not going to spend a lot of time looking at chapter 38. It's difficult to even read it, isn't it? And we tend to jump straight over it. And almost every study I've ever heard on Joseph goes from the end of chapter 37 straight into chapter 39 because the two are connected like that, just like hand in the glove. The end of chapter 37 and the start of chapter 39 are meant to just link like that. But God put chapter 38 right in the middle. At that very point, God put this chapter. The divine penman made sure that we had to understand something. And if we don't get this, brethren and sisters, if we don't see the point of this chapter in here, we're going to miss a vital link in the story of Joseph. It's absolutely vital. You know, we know a lot about his brethren already. We know how terrible they were. We don't need that to be all reinforced. But now we've got a whole chapter focused on Judah. Just one of those brethren. Not the whole lot, just one. And look how it starts, verse 1. It came to pass at that time that Judah went down from his brethren and turned into a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira, and he saw a daughter of the Canaanites and he married her. Now this isn't at the same time. It doesn't. It says, and it came to pass at that time. It can't have been that time. You can prove beyond any doubt that the chronology doesn't allow it to happen at that time. Because we know this, and we'll have a look at this in just a moment, that Judah's sons by Phares went down to Egypt 22 years later. And there's got to be generations in there. So it can't possibly happen. You try anything you like and you can't fit the chronology in there for this chapter to start at that time. So what's the record actually telling us? What is it saying? Well, some of this in this chapter happened much earlier. Some of it was happening around the time that we've got here. But some of it happened much earlier. You know, but for some reason God has seen that it's important here at this very point in Joseph's life that we know this detail. It's not inserted in the middle of chapter 39 or chapter 40 or halfway through chapter 37. It's inserted right here at the point where Joseph is going down to Egypt and he's in terrible straits. He doesn't know what's happening to him. He's being unjustly treated and he is in great anguish of soul. Well, we know this, that it tells us that Judah went down from his brethren. Went down from his brethren. And he did that in every sense. And his brethren weren't much to go down from. And he went down. And he went down to Hira the Adullamite. Hira's name means splendor. And he was not. He lived actually not far from Hebron, because Adullam is not far from Hebron. And in this chapter, this man Hira is called his friend twice. Verse 12 and verse 20. So he's also involved in sharing all the exploits of Judah in this chapter. And his name means splendor. And we've got Judah now being mesmerized by some splendor out there. And he's got worldly friends out of the truth. The friendship of the world is enmity with God. He's on a very slippery path. And he sees in verse 2 a daughter of the Canaanite and he marries her. Well, what do you think Jacob would have thought about that? And what do you think Isaac would have thought about that? Because Isaac was still back there in Hebron. You know, this Canaanite woman was the daughter of Shuah, and the word means affluence. You can see where Judah's problem is. He's just out for a good time, and he's out for affluence. He sold his brother for silver, and he's in the previous chapter here, and he marries now outside the truth. You know, that's only the start of the problems in Judah's life. And as is always the case when we start on a slippery downhill slide. And young people, please, just take a lesson from this. Because here's a young man who's going, making friends outside the world. The next step is he marries outside and his life just falls in absolute pieces around him. His children, we read in that chapter, were absolutely perverse, so much so that one of them was so wicked that Yahweh slew him. Unbelievable. You hardly ever read that in the whole of the record of the Bible. Yahweh actively targeting a man and slaying him. And then his brother's got to raise up seed, and he's so wicked, God takes him out. Two children are so perverse in that family that God intervenes miraculously and takes them out. And not only that, Judah himself is so dishonorable that he won't give his third son to Tamar. He's then deceived by her. He picks up a harlot. He goes, so he thinks, and then his reaction when he finds out that his daughter-in-law is with child, he says, "Bring her here and burn her." What sort of man is this? The patriarchs are indeed in terrible turmoil. And then there's twins born, there's confusion about who's the firstborn, who's not. Look, the whole chapter ends in absolute anarchy. Well, this chronology is actually a bit tricky to piece together. And I'm not going to suggest that this is absolutely correct. But if we just take the blue line is Jacob's life. There's Joseph, born when Jacob was about 90. And Judah, of course, was born much earlier. He was the fourth child. And that's about as early as you can possibly get Judah being born. So that's just a rough parallel of their lives. Okay. Now, what we do know, there's just the other details about Judah's sons. Okay, we'll come to that in just a moment. I'm not going to spend a lot of time here, but Jacob goes into Egypt at the age of 130. So we have a point there at which we know that Hezron and his brother down here in yellow were actually born at that stage, and they went into the land as well at the same time. Well, so we've got to account for that and somehow work backwards. Well, we know this. Whoops, not that backwards. That Jacob returned to the land at the age of about 97. Joseph was only about 7 or 8 at the time. Judah's about 30. And at that stage, we find there's a gap of about 22 years between those two pink lines, in which all the details of this chapter can't possibly fit. So, what are the implications of all this? Here we've got Joseph being sold by his brethren. So even though it looks like crisscross rainbow, you think you can understand what's going on there. Well, it's only the big picture that we want at the moment. Well, look at this. At 17, 18, there's Joseph being sold by his brethren into Egypt. At around about late teens, okay? We don't know exactly what age, because we're told he was 17, and it was shortly after that he was sold. Whether he was 17, 18, we don't know, but it's around about that time. But look at this. When you just work that chronology backwards to try and fit these events in, this is what we find. That Judah was about 17 when he got married. That is, what's Judah doing at 17? He's out with the world. He's out with friends in the world. He finds a girl in the world and he marries her. All right? He has two sons. Three sons, actually, to start with. But the first son is struck down dead. Now, there's almost no way that you can fit all this in unless you assume that that son was also married very early and was in his late teens. And at about 17, the next generation struck dead by God. And the next... unbelievable. That's the same age as Joseph was. And Joseph's seen some of that all happen. But not only that, at about the same time, if you have a look there, about the same time that Joseph is sold by his brethren, and this is all approximate, but around about that time, you just have a look at, you follow that middle pink line down, what do you find? That's the time Phares is born to Tamar. That's when the centerpiece of this chapter is happening. So the at that time is actually talking about what Judah is up to at the time he's selling his brother into slavery. He's deceiving everybody. He finds a woman who thinks is a harlot, who actually ends up being his daughter-in-law, has a child by her, and then wants to burn her. Now, I think any of us, brethren and sisters, when we try and put some of that together, would say this man is just beyond hope. It certainly seems as though he is. How much worse could you get? And I think most of us would have given up. But you know, God didn't give up on this man. Because God is willing that none should perish, but that all should come to a knowledge of the truth. And God will go at times to extraordinary lengths to save those he's called to his purpose. And already God, at this point, when we just look at chapter 38, we see him at work in Judah's life. Already things are happening that are making Judah think. But the greatest length that God went to, the greatest length that he went to, thinking, well, if he doesn't respond to this, he'll respond to nothing, is to send, inverted commas, his only beloved son and allow him to suffer in order that he might save him. Because at the very depth of perversity in this man's life, this man is actually contributing, not contributing, he's the brains behind getting rid of Joseph. And Joseph goes into Egypt, is allowed to suffer there in order to prepare the way for God to bring back this man. That is just a staggering thing that's built into this story. You know, brothers and sisters, let me read these words. Perhaps go there. Let's go there. You know these words very well. Most of us could recite them. And Romans 5. Romans 5 and at verse 8. The apostle says, "But God commendeth his love toward us, in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us." So Christ is going through the sufferings through his ministry and the painful, shameful death unjustly, while we are yet sinners. That's Judah's position. Judah is in the depth of depravity, and at that very time, God sends off this innocent young lad into Egypt at the instigation of Judah, mind you, so that he might save him. That is just an amazing thing. And at verse 10 goes on to say, "For if, when we were enemies, we were reconciled to God by the death of his son, much more being reconciled, we shall be saved by his life." And it was just that that was in the end going to save Judah and his brethren. It was the life of this man, having come out of resurrection, come through a resurrection, that was going to eventually save this man. It's an amazing little just glance on this wonderful, massive parable of salvation that's hidden behind this. But who of us, brethren and sisters, are worth saving? I mean, we can see that Judah wasn't worth saving. But is there any of us that can claim that we're worth saving? And yet God sent his own son into the world to preserve life and to leave open the way to the tree of life for all of us. You know, this Genesis record is interrupted here at this very, very point in time between chapter 37 and 39. In the very midst of Joseph's suffering, to tell us why Joseph is suffering. Now, brothers and sisters, that's the point of chapter 39. It's telling us why Joseph is on his way to Egypt. Joseph didn't understand at that time exactly why and what God was doing him. He put things together as he went along further in his life, and he started to piece it all together. But it's telling us why all this was happening. It wasn't because of all his sins. It wasn't that he'd done anything wrong. It was because God was in absolute control and God was going to use him to save his brethren. And God's repeated that process time and again. He's repeated it marvellously in the work of his son, but he's repeated it in many faithful people's lives, brothers and sisters. And at times, our own sufferings may well be for the sake of others. God can and does use the sufferings that we go through to help others come to the truth and to see an example of faith and steadfastness through that. But let's never, ever also forget, brothers and sisters, that others may well be suffering for us, for our sake. That God is actually working in the lives of others to turn us around. I'd like you to come over to Psalm 80. This is a wonderful psalm that's got echoes all the way through it of Joseph's life. Psalm 80. So we haven't really got time to do it justice tonight, but just let's pick a couple of little thoughts out of here. Psalm 80, starting at verse 1, where the psalmist says, "Give ear, O shepherd of Israel, thou that leadest Joseph like a flock, thou that dwellest in the cherubim, shine forth." Let's just stop for a minute. Yahweh is described as a great shepherd. And a great shepherd is that one that cares for all the sheep and is prepared to seek out that which is lost. It's the characteristic that we find so eminently described in Joseph's life. And the very first thing we find out about Joseph is that he was a shepherd. He was tending his father's flock. And he went on from there to shepherd men and to bring his own brothers through a path that God was leading. But look at what the psalmist is saying here. "O shepherd of Israel, thou that leadest Joseph like a flock." Now, you might have thought, leadest Joseph like, you know, an individual, like a lamb. But no, leadest Joseph like a flock. It's a multitude. A flock is a whole raft of sheep. And here, God is leading Joseph like a flock. You know, it's as if he's leading Joseph and, by implication, there's a whole flock also following after. And that Joseph himself is the one who is influencing all those. Well, you know, that's exactly what God does. He leads us as a shepherd leads a sheep. But he leads us to the point where we can take over what he's doing and lead others. In fact, he actually works through individuals as a shepherd. God does not appear amongst men in his own person, but through men. And here, God's leading was happening through Joseph. Well, look at the cry of this psalm, verse 3. "Turn us again, O God, and cause thy face to shine, and we shall be saved." Turn us again? Here's someone that's wayward, that's not responded the first time, but needs turning again. You know, this is the cry of this psalm, verse 3, verse 7, verse 19, three times. "Turn us again, O God, and cause thy face that we may be saved. Turn us again." You know, but there's an interesting thing in that each time that phrase is used, it's not the same title. "Turn us again, O God, mighty ones." "Turn us again," verse 7, "O God of hosts." And verse 19, "Turn us again, O Yahweh, Elohim of hosts." So there's a growing understanding here as the turning is actually happening in the lives of those to whom this psalm was really first intended. That this turning will lead us further and closer to the full manifestation of Yahweh in a multitude of mighty ones. Starts off not appreciating just quite the extent of that manifestation, but in the end, the turning again. And how is God going to do that? Verse 17. "Let thy hand be upon the man of thy right hand, upon the son of man whom thou madest strong for thyself." You know, we know, of course, that's a title that's used of our Lord Jesus Christ, the one who he made strong for himself. And unquestionably, this is messianic and talking about Christ. But that also applies to Joseph, and it applies to all of us, brethren and sisters, because God is going to strengthen the hands of individuals who will be shepherds in their own midst, who are going to turn again the lives of others with whom they have to do within the flock. They're going to turn again and bring them and to an increasing appreciation of who God is and what the purpose of that turning is. Because God is going to work through individuals to turn. So, you know, brothers and sisters, I find great comfort in that psalm and in the whole story of Joseph, because what God is doing is turning again those brethren. He's giving them every chance, and he even goes to the length to put his own son, so to speak, the only faithful owner of the promises, through great tribulation, that he might finally win over and turn around those wayward brethren that had gotten themselves into so much difficulty through their own folly. And yet, in the end, God will bring them through and turn them again and unite them with the great Joseph. Well, I was hoping to get just a little further tonight, but I think we'll have to call it a day, and we'll pick it up, the story from the start of chapter 39, on our next class.